Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's day two of Heal Your Mojo Experts that are here to assist you to create consciously. And we are delivering to you today tips to trust your body creativity, your body wisdom, later this afternoon your value, and your gut and your gut knowing. So up first, we're going to hear from Alan Questel, who is a star teacher in the Feldenkrais world. Alan Questel is known for his clarity, creativity, and down-to-earth style of teaching while bringing a depth of understanding, humor, and a gentle human perspective to learning the method. Trained by Dr. Feldenkrais, he teaches his Feldenkrais professional training programs in the USA, in Australia, Europe, Japan, and South America. He's all over the place. He is the author of Creating Creativity, Embodying the Creative Process, and he's also the creator of Pregnant Pauses, Movement for Moms, their DVDs. And he's also done numerous Feldenkrais Awareness through Movement CD sets for the public. His current trainings are in Malmo, Sweden, Cali, Colombia, and upcoming in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which he's going to talk about at the very end of our chat here. So welcome, Alan, to Heal Your Mojo.
Hi, Janine. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great. I love the work that you do, and I know a couple of Feldenkrais practitioners who, when I mentioned that I was interviewing you, they were just in awe.
Thank you.
So that's a good way to start out the day, right?
That's good. I try to stay on the humble side, but I appreciate that. That's good.
So tell me, how did you get started with Feldenkrais and what drew you to it?
Well, I got into Feldenkrais through my own back injury. And actually, you know, people don't know, but Janine and I went to college together and studied acting. So when I was an actor, to make money, I had a construction business. And I was actually, our acting teacher had introduced us to Feldenkrais, and I read the book, and I thought the thinking behind it was really interesting, but the movements didn't really make any sense to me. And then sometime later, I hurt my back when I was wallpapering our acting teacher's bathroom, and he said, go see this Feldenkrais guy. And I said, no, that's nonsense. And I went to a chiropractor, and he slid into me like third base, and after that, I could straighten up, but my pain was worse. I then had sciatica. So I thought I'd try this Feldenkrais guy, and I was in my New York pace moving really fast like this, and he was kind of moving like this, and he put me kneeling over a table, and he started barely touching me, and I thought, oh, this is a waste of time, and it's expensive, a waste of money. And I got up, and I had no pain. And I was shocked. I said, what'd you do? And he said, you did it. And I said, no, really, what did you do? He said, really, I was helping your body do what it's doing. And I thought, it's a secret, huh?
And
Three days later, I was driving on the FDR Drive in New York, which is like a pinball machine for cars, and I noticed I wasn't getting angry. And I thought, what happened to me? These people are cutting me off and I'm calm, you know. And all I kept thinking of was this Feldenkrais lesson. So I went back a second time. I had no pain. And I thought, I'll try to figure it out. And he touched me with the same quality but in completely different places. And after the I went back again after that. And after the third time, I thought, I want to learn this. And I actually thought I could pursue acting full-time and do this part-time. And, of course, what ended up happening was I left acting, and Feldenkrais has been my life for over 30 years now.
And when you mentioned quality of touch, you said he touched you with the same quality.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe in any way, for us what that quality might be? I know it's hard just using your voice, but
I can give you some ideas. So one thing is that the contact that we make is skeletal, meaning that I'm looking for a skeletal handle when I'm touching someone or moving someone. But then the size of the movements are very, very, very small. And so what we're looking at is for the smallest change in quality that's usually indicative of someone's movement habits. And so I'm really working around the initiation of any action. And if I produce a change around that level of participation, that usually develops into the larger action later being much more elegant, proficient, easier, less pain, things like that. And I would say that the quality of touch that I look for when I'm touching someone is that they don't feel my hands, but they feel their own movement.
Mm. So is that on a cellular level sometimes when you're talking about the smaller moving out to the larger?
Well, You know, in one sense, I could say any kind of interaction is a cellular interaction.
That's true.
You know,
yeah.
But I'm not thinking of it cellularly. I'm thinking of it more in terms of the quality, so that, let's say, someone's on their side and I'm moving their shoulder forward. I do a very small movement, and the minute I feel that, oh, there's a slight bit of resistance or a little jumps or jerks, I'm not going to go any further. Because those jumps or jerks or that resistance is an indication of that person's nervous system saying, I don't know how to really go further than this. Now, of course, they can move themselves further, and I can push them further. But in terms of learning, which is the basic context that we're exploring movement in, that's the place where the nervous system is more available for learning.
Yes, when it's not feeling attacked.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, have you noticed over the years, I know you've been teaching all over the world, we've been talking about healing and creativity during this series. Have you noticed that the work has affected people creatively, and can you speak to that?
Well, yeah, I can definitely speak to that. And I think I'll speak first from my own personal experience with
great.
It.
Great, great.
Which was, you know, the Feldenkrais training was 4 years long. And in the second year of my training with Dr. Feldenkrais, I sat up and I thought, this guy is teaching creativity. And I then thought, oh, the audacity. You know, how do you teach 220 people to be creative? And, of course, you know, years later I went on to write a book about it, so maybe there's more audacity in that. I don't know. but I think to answer the question, we have to look at the question of what is creativity.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm teaching a group and I ask the question, so who here is creative? I get three really clear responses. One response is a number of people shoot their hands in the air. Another response is that some people slowly raise their hands while they're looking around. And then the third response is a bunch of people who just look down like they're depressed because they don't think they're creative.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ask another question. I say, so do you know someone who's creative? And everybody raises their hand. And so I said, well, what's the difference? And people come up with all kinds of differences that are all reasonable. I'm not looking for a fixed definition. But one thing I think can be said for someone who we think is more creative than ourselves is they see choices or generate choices that we don't see. So someone takes a Chinese parasol and they turn it upside down and make a light fixture on it with it. And you come into the house and you go, oh, that's so cool. I never would have thought of that. How creative. And so really my idea of creativity is learning how to generate choices. And I heard Mike Nichols once say about Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson as actors that what he loved about them was they brought in so many choices for him to choose from.
Mm.
You know, and now that comes to something else. And, you know, if we come back to healing and movement, well, then it's a question of what helps someone heal, right? And, you know, I said the Feldenkrais method, we're looking at things more from the perspective of learning. But, of course, people heal from learning. But how do they heal? Well, one of the major tenets that we explore in the Feldenkrais method is creating more choice. So we're not trying to teach the right way to move, but we're teaching more choices so that someone who has a pain can learn to move in another way and then eliminate the pain as a result of that.
So options.
Yes. So when I go back to your first question about have I seen people becoming more creative as I've taught them over the years, the answer is definitely yes. But it's not happening so directly that they notice it at first, because what they're learning to do through their movement is learn to create more choices all the time.
Mm.
And that results in a change in their thinking, their feeling, their sensing, and how they act in the world. And people often come back and say, you know, I do things differently now. I'm able to see things from other perspectives. And it's very different learning it when you're intentionally trying to become more creative.
Yes, of course, right.
Then you're already boxed in, you know, because you've got a fixed outcome, a goal you're trying to achieve, and you're trapped by your existing thinking.
And by the linear, which,
absolutely.
Of course, in the body we know doesn't move in a linear way when it's moving naturally.
Absolutely. But if you start exploring it through movement generally without people knowing where they're going and not predicting or trying to get someplace, what happens is that forms a bridge with their everyday life, and they start to act differently as a result.
That's just great.
Yeah.
Well, because I know we're always putting out fires, whether it's with our brain or in our body, and we're doing that so often that we're predisposed to looking for the next fire rather than looking for the ease in our body. So it can be challenging to feel safe. I think probably that's why some people just looked down when you asked that question, the third group of people. They just looked down because it's kind of a sad thing to imagine, I think, a life without being able to have choices, and that's really what it comes down to.
Definitely. And I think that the people who look down, what we're really starting to reflect on here is someone's self-image and how they think of themselves.
Yes.
You know, and that becomes a big factor. So, you know, how does our self-image change, right? And again, if you consciously try to change it, what do? You wear different clothes or cut your hair, but internally how we change it is more challenging.
Well, and it can be like a detective, going on a detective, you know, like playing a game of Clue in a way.
But it
takes a perspective shift to see things that way rather than being afraid to open a Pandora's box or, oh, if I look inside, what's there?
That's right. And, you know, the truth is, I mean, if we think of, again, of the context of learning, what needs to be there is a safe environment where someone feels free to make mistakes, not one where they have to be good or accomplish something or achieve something. And, you know, you said something earlier that struck me. I'm trying to think. It was about putting out fires, you know. And so, you know, that sort of sets up a whole way of being in the world, of just being ready for the next problem.
Yeah.
And one way, you know, another question that I ask people sometimes is, I say, so when do you get comfortable? And really the answer most people come up with is, oh, I guess when I'm uncomfortable. And I said, well, you know, if you think about that, that's a crazy criteria. That means we have to wait till we're uncomfortable to get comfortable.
Mm.
And so, you know, in Feldenkrais, what we're looking to do is to create a use of ourself that's easier, more fluid, more comfortable. You know, so what I do with a child with cerebral palsy or a professional athlete, it's the same ideas, you know. And so that they get movement to translate through them skeletally in a way that they function more efficiently.
And so does sound play an element in that at all in your work?
Not really, no. Other than the sound of my voice when I'm teaching, you know, which has to create a context where, again, someone feels safe.
Well, there's that trust factor.
Yeah, that's big. That's big. But, you know, there's another basic idea in the Feldenkrais method that I believe relates to creativity as well. And that is that we become more skeletal in our use of ourselves. So I mentioned before when I'm touching someone, I'm looking for a kind of handle that's through their skeleton. So the skeleton is the part of ourselves that bears weight and transmits force. And we tend to underuse that and overuse our musculature. So a Feldenkrais lesson, whether it's a private lesson or a class lesson, a lot of it's about a very gentle deconstruction of our muscular habits.
Mm.
And the result of that is we're more skeletal. And then our muscles aren't working against each other or in contradictory ways or in unnecessary or parasitic ways. And so that's why I said, you know, working with a kid with CP or a professional athlete or someone with back pain, it's the same idea behind it. How do we get more skeletal?
And, so could you say, when you say get more skeletal, would you say that that's also getting more efficient?
Definitely.
Am I understanding that correctly? Okay.
Yeah, definitely, because if I'm bearing weight through my skeleton, it means I'm not holding myself up so much with my muscles. And that actually changes our brain, too, because our brain is occupied with doing something muscularly, and if we can diminish that activity, all of a sudden the brain is free to do other things. And if I relate that, when I started to work on my book on creativity, I started to think, well, how does this help someone in the creative process? And, you know, one thing that's, people have all kinds of, I think, mistaken ideas about the creative process, like it's this wonderful state that you exist in. But if you speak with creative people, they'll tell you it's a lot of work, you know. There's a moment of inspiration, and then, you know, weeks, days, months, years of work, whatever it takes for whatever they're doing. And of course, it can be like an emotional roller coaster where we're thrown all over the place. Some days we feel great. Some days we feel terrible. And the question is, how do we mobilize ourselves and motivate ourselves to keep going forward? And one of the things that I found that helps us emotionally is to have more of a skeletal sense of ourselves. So we can tolerate more pressure, weight, heaviness, anything that bears down on us, as the world can sometimes do. And, you know, I was teaching a workshop once on this, and one woman said that the thing that sustains people is their stories. And I said, well, give me an example. And she said, the people in concentration camps. And at the moment when she said it, I went, wow, she's right. They didn't think of their skeleton. They were skeletons, for God's sake.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And their stories carried them through. But then upon reflecting on it, I started to think that actually the stories only work when you're in a life and death situation. Because in everyday life, you tell yourself a story and the next day you forget it. You know, it's hard to sustain it. But when you're threatened all the time, the stories, you need the stories. They work.
But isn't it interesting that even, I mean, you mentioned the concentration camps, but really in modern day, you know, driving down the FDR, as you described earlier, our nervous systems can be in that state, can be reacting in that fight or flight state, in that highly, non-peaceful state as well. Don't you find that people are just really out of their bodies?
Oh, yeah. But I would see it on a continuum. So I think there's a difference between driving in crazy traffic, like in India or something like that, where people drive like maniacs, or really being physically threatened face to face. You know, and I think, but they're on a continuum. I think they do connect for sure in some way. And you know, if we think about just our everyday anxiety or pressure or stress that you know could be reflected in the driving situation, for example. The question is, how do we find more equanimity in that? And some people, I think, again, with a mistaken idea that they just shouldn't be anxious or shouldn't be upset. And I think, no, it's not that those feelings don't arise, but how quickly can we move or transit away from them?
Right, allow the ebb and flow.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where movement becomes really significant. Because if you're practicing moving and shifting all the time, again, that starts to color into other areas of our life as well.
But it's an easeful and a purposeful and a specific movement. It's not the kind of movement that people use to distract themselves and just sort of stay busy, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like in Feldenkrais Awareness through Movement classes, the movements, there's a structure to them. And, you know, one of the structures is mechanical. So, like I said, to evoke a more skeletal use of oneself so that the skeleton, one part of the skeleton moves and connects to the next and to the next and to the next in a way that the larger muscles of the body start doing more of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And when that starts to happen, people feel, oh, I don't get, my breathing is easier, for example. And when someone's breathing is easier, then usually they were, you know, years ago, I used to think if I had one wish, it would be $1 million. And then, you know, some years later, I thought, no, it needs to be $2 million. And then I thought one day, I thought, you know, better than that would be able to breathe easily at all times. So, oh, you crashed the car? Oh, he died? And just be able to breathe through those moments instead of just contracting and reacting to everything like you
yes,
said before.
Yes, reacting and being triggered. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So how do people start to learn this process with you? How would they start that? In terms of you were saying, you know, you meet the body sort of where it is on a skeletal handle, but that you allow for the resistance and you, in fact, honor the resistance.
Yeah.
You don't go further, which I know that's what I do in craniosacral work as well. It's really important.
Right.
So what would that look like?
Well, what dictates a large part of it is a functional theme, meaning that I'm interested, like if a person, let's say, has pain in their neck, I want to know when they have pain in their neck. Is it when you turn? Is it when you look up or down? Let's say it's when they turn. So I'm looking at the rest of them and how they move. And I can see, and let's say, sort of two things stand out usually when someone has pain in their neck like that. One is that they're moving in their neck and everything else isn't moving. So there's no movement through their spine or their ribs, their pelvis or their hips. Or some people move everything but hold the neck, so they get pain from that. So I'm looking to distribute movement more and more throughout their whole system. So if someone doesn't move their ribs, they have pain in their neck, I really don't touch their neck very much. I'm really looking to see how the ribs move, how that connects to their hip joints, how they stand on their feet. And often people get up and go, like I did, what'd you do? Because I didn't touch the area that was inflamed or irritated.
Right.
Yeah.
That's so important, and I think that's the way of the way healing modalities are going these days. I mean, certainly the more elegant work.
Well, you know, I think that there's something bigger than that, which is I think that's the place where the nervous system is receptive. And, you know, people used to talk about Feldenkrais as this neurological event, you know, and then one day I thought, well, wait a minute, everything's a neurological event. It's like the cellulose question. We're nervous
right.
system. So
right.
everything that happens in us is a neurological event. So then the question is, what's different? And then it's that gentleness that the nervous system can start to go, huh? What are you doing? Right? And there's another aspect to it, too, that becomes important for our nervous system, which is the idea of novelty. So it's not just repetitive movements over and over again, but it's movements that demand, like you said, a kind of inquiry into, well, how do I do that? What am I doing? And then discovery, because when there's a discovery, that's like our nervous system lighting up all over the place. Our brain sort of goes crazy.
Hmm.
It does the same thing with laughter, too.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Actually, we're going to have another speaker tomorrow who does that. She does it as one of the exercises where you have to laugh for a minute.
Uh-huh.
And I think this is funny. We learned this back in college.
Right.
The whole idea that, you know, if you smile, whether you feel like it or not, your body gets the message
of
smile.
It makes a big difference. And, you know, Janine knows me really well with my humor, which has gotten me into more trouble than you could ever imagine. And actually, on one of my websites is an article. I think it's posted already. If not, I'll post it soon. An article I wrote about humor. And one of the things that I discovered, and this is my personal theory, and on a physiological level, when we laugh or even when we cry, is that, let's say we have our diaphragm is sort of held habitually in a place. And then we laugh, and the diaphragm moves to its extremes of ha, 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 ha. And when it stops moving, it settles in a more neutral place. And hence we feel better after we laugh or cry as well. And so I think there are actually real... There's the neurological aspect, but there's also the physiological aspect of it as well that tells us, this is what helps me feel better.
And it's funny because that's so true. And I just got a flash that you're kind of finding the health in that. Like when you're laughing, you're finding the health. The idea that anyone can find disease, but who can find the health? And that's kind of what you're looking for, isn't it? When you're laughing or you're looking, you're honoring the resistance. You're really in a dance with the body. Yeah.
Well, I think it speaks to health on another level as well, which is, how do I say it? So what does it mean to be healthy, right? And so when I laugh hard or cry hard, my diaphragm is a more neutral place, it means that I have more freedom now to move in other directions. If my diaphragm is held up or pushed down, then there's not so much freedom in my breathing, in my laughing, and anything like that.
Mm.
And one of Feldenkrais's definitions of health was pretty interesting. He thought you can measure someone's health by how quickly they recover from a trauma or an accident. Because, look, you and I, we're healthy, but we can go out in the street, get hit by a car, and wham, are we not healthy all of a sudden?
Right.
And I remember Christopher Reeves when he had this horseback riding accident.
Yes.
And I watched him interviewed on Barbara Walters, and I was so moved by it that I immediately sent him all of Feldenkrais's books. But what struck me was he was like just a perfect specimen of health because he was just going forward still.
Right.
It didn't stop him.
Right.
You know? So.
So that's that brings the spirit into relationship with the body then.
Sure.
Doesn't?
Yeah. Definitely.
So awesome.
Yeah.
So tell everybody, because I know that you have some lovely offers for people, but also there is a free blog that you're doing, is it?
No, it's not a blog. It's there's several things. If you go to my websites, my uncommon web Uncommon Sensing website and my Feldenkrais Training in Santa Fe website, there's all kinds of free materials. There's articles, there's podcasts, there's free awareness through movement lessons. And then if you go to Uncommon Sensing and subscribe there, then for free, for now on, because I've got years of material, you can get a free awareness through movement lesson every month from now on. It's automatically sent to you.
That sounds great.
Yeah. And then the offer for this conference is that if anyone buys something from one of my websites, they can use the code MOJO10 and get 10% off the first item and up to close to 30% off if they order two or more items. And if you order something, I'll also send you a copy of my book, a PDF of my book, Creating Creativity, Embodying Creativity.
And that book is incredible. I mean, that's quite, it's not like a little tiny 20-page ebook. It's a really in-depth. And no, well, because some people say, oh, and you'll get my book, and then you get it, and it's like 5 pages, you know.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. No, I wrote it as a book.
Really, your book?
Yeah. That's a book? Oh, interesting. Nice pamphlet, yeah.
Right. So, no, this is a serious, when he's talking about his book, it's he's talking serious. It's a serious book, and it's very, very cool. So I'm wondering if you can give people maybe, is there some kind of imagery or some type of self-help to allow them to begin the inquiry into their skeletal being? Is there anything that you can give tip-wise to people?
Yeah,
or?
I could say, you know, like I said, generally the awareness through movement lessons are quite structured to evoke certain relationships in movement and within ourselves. And there's over 1,000 lessons, and they range from small, almost invisible movements to learning how to stand on your head. But I would say one thing, if someone is looking to become more skeletal, it's to start to pay attention to the relationship to the ground. So, for example, if you were sitting in your chair and you were going to stand, if you just stood up, people just stand up without thinking about it. But if you stand up by actually pushing your feet into the floor, it changes something. If you're rolling over in bed, instead of just rolling over, think, can I push against the mattress that, or the surface that I'm lying on? And see, how does that influence my sense of myself enrolling? And, you know, there's one other thing I didn't talk about that I'd like to just spend a minute talking about because it speaks to this.
Oh, please, please.
Yeah,
this is great.
I think that years ago I was putting together a workshop on self-image. And the more I investigated self-image, the more I started to think that it revolved around a pretty simple idea, and without being too reductionistic. And that idea was, my self-image, it was a reflection of how much I like myself or how much I don't like myself. And if I like myself, I have a good self-image, and if I don't like myself, I don't have such a great self-image. And, you know, again, when I teach that, I say, well, I need to know, is there anyone here who doesn't want to like themselves more? And, of course, people always laugh at that because who doesn't want to like themselves more? Well, once in Norway, a woman raised her hand and said, I already like myself. And I said, that wasn't the question. The question was, do you like to like yourself more? And she kind of went, okay, like I was doing her a favor. Okay, that was a little weird. But then the question is, now the minute we start to explore liking ourselves, we find all the things we don't like. So it's a real challenge to stay kind to ourselves and gentle to with ourselves in that process. And, of course, then the next question is, how do we do it? Do you do affirmations? You sit there for 20 minutes going, I like myself. Well, yeah, that can help some people, but it doesn't usually stay. And so when I teach the Feldenkrais method, one of the things I'm always asking people to do is to move in a way that you like the way it feels, that you practice that. And that's what we all did as children. You know, when I talked earlier about getting uncomfortable to get comfortable,
yeah.
Children don't wait till they're uncomfortable. They're constantly looking for a greater state of comfort.
Yes, and we've learned always moving towards it where we have to think about it.
Right. We've learned to tolerate this discomfort from sitting in chairs and sitting at computers and our jobs and things like that. We've lost the ability to stay mobile in the world. And so, you know, when I come back to the idea of moving against the ground to get more skeletal, one of the results that people have from that is they start to feel, I actually start to like the way I feel right now more. And if I like the way I feel, I start to like myself more. And that starts to permeate one's self-image through all one's activities, not just rolling over in bed. And that's where I think that can really impact on people's lives.
That's a really great image. It's like, so you're doing what you always do. You get up from your desk, you roll over in bed, but you're doing it with a different focus.
Right, a different use of our attention, and that different attention starts to change how we actually use ourselves in action.
That's fantastic. Well, I hope everybody will experiment with that, and you'll feel free to report back.
Yep. And if they have questions, they can always email me, too. I'm always happy to have conversations.
And what's the best email for you?
Alan, A-L-A-N, at uncommonsensing.com.
That's terrific. And so now you have an upcoming workshop teaching that you're doing. Did you want to share about that?
It's more than a workshop. It's an upcoming four-year Feldenkrais training program.
Oh, yikes.
In New Mexico. You didn't know that. No, yeah. I mean, I teach workshops all over.
Is it one of those five-page books?
No, this is a four-year book, yeah. But it meets 40 days a year, and it's both a personal and a professional process for someone to become a Feldenkrais practitioner and then to be able to do all the things that I was talking about. And, of course, a lot of people just do it for their own personal development and growth, and that's a fine reason to do it. And that, the website for that is www.feldenkraisinsantafe.com, and that's F-E-L-D-E-N-K-R-A-I-S, no T.
And I think people also, if they go to the gift page, they'll see that spelled out
in case they're
driving and weren't able to catch that.
No texting now, but not while you're driving,
But, well, this has just been so much fun. And I really think you gave people some really wonderful food for thought, and then also some lovely things that they can actually put into practice. And I highly recommend that that you do take a look at what he's having to offer, because getting that book with something as a purchase is just a huge, it's really a huge offer. It's a huge gift. The book is pretty amazing. So
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you for organizing all this for everybody. I think it's really fantastic.
Yes, well, that's my way of sort of being, you know, inclusive rather than exclusive, and just bringing everyone I know who's amazing and some people that I didn't know before this event, you know, together to create, you know, some synergy.
Yeah.
And I think the world really needs it right now. So this is my little humble offering.
That's great. It's a big one. That's a big one. So thank you.
Okay, well, take care, Alan, and I'll talk to you soon. Lots of love.
All right, lots of love to you, too.
And
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. And everyone, we've got a call. Our next call is Suzanne Scurlock-Durana, and I will meet you back here at 12 Pacific. Take care now.